Connection for Life, and this is the connection. Do you whistle while you work, connection listeners? Is your job your daily humiliation or your real liberation? Our guest, Joanne Chula, is interested in everything about the work you do for pay, factory work, Dilbert cubicle work, heavy lifting work or make work, have a nice day sales work, field general work overseeing other people's work, creative work, life-saving work, drudge work. Joanne Chula is a teacher and writer with a philosophical bent who knows that a lot of people love their work passionately as she loves hers, but she also wonders why so many of us Americans in what could be fat and leisurely times invest more and more of our time and ambition in the jobs we do for a living far past what we need to live. Should we blame the ancient Aesop's fable for celebrating the busy bee, or the Bible for making a model of the industrious ant, as in the 6th chapter of Proverbs, where it says, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways, and be wise." Connection listeners, what's so scary about leisure in your life, about contemplation, or bowling, or just going home and making music with your kids? If you hate your boss and your job and your office as much as Dilbert does, why do you give it 12, 14, 16 hours a day? Our phone to the Working Life Connection is 1-800-423-8255. What's so great about work anyway? And do we have to work this hard? 1-800-423-TALK. Joanne Chula's wonderful book is called The Working Life, the subtitle, The Promise and Betrayal of Modern Work. Welcome, Joanne Chula. What do you mean by the promise and what do you mean by the betrayal?
Well, the promise of work, first, at its simplest level, is that work certainly promises to put food on the table. That's our simplest reason why we go to work. And work also promises a lot of other things. It promises a feeling of satisfaction when we do a job well. It promises, for many people, meaning in their lives. Work also promises people stature in a community. So the promise of work can be all sorts of good things on a personal, social, and material level. And that's one of the reasons why we like work. And often work delivers on this promise, but often it doesn't.
What do you mean by betrayal?
Okay, we get to betrayal. The betrayal of work, and here I'm looking at work today, is that work cannot live up to the promise that our society has embedded in it. And by that I mean that work is so much an element of our social status, it's so much of an element of our identity today, that many people are working like mad at their paid employment and hoping to get gratification and meaning out of it, when actually they're getting more and more sucked into something that is making the rest of their lives miserable. So the betrayal is that work doesn't always deliver those things. And here I want to be very specific. It's paid work. It's what you do for a living. There's all kinds of work in life besides what you do on the job.
Are you talking about the alienation of labor in the old Marxist phrase?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think one of the things Marx really understood about work was that if people had no time to do anything else in their lives, he says that what happens is that they're only human when they're at work, and when they're at home, they're consumed with their animal functions, which is eating and sleeping and doing the laundry and other things. Now, that's very provocative.
I also thought just that once people got to be aware that they were trading away for profit the best part of their day, mm-hmm. it was emotionally, deeply distressing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was very distressing.
To the point of revolution.
Well, yeah, I mean, in that part maybe he was wrong about, because we haven't seen any of those revolutions per se. And part of the problem with Marx's view of work is he was looking at people who were just working and not getting anywhere. These were people who were paid barely subsistence wages. So I think Marx's view of work is that people were alienated because they were alienated from actually living a rich life because of their work. And that's an interesting question for us today, as well as back in Marx's time, for a different set of reasons.
But I want to toss it back, though, to you and sort of say, why do you knock work so much when, for so many people, and I think for you and me both, we come to think, we are our work. Lots mm-hmm. of people. In the beginning, in just the acknowledgments of your book, you note that this book, of which you ought to be enormously proud, that the book has been a part of my life for a long time. It's your work and it's your joy. One of your greatest pleasures, you write, has been corresponding with your editor about the ideas in this book. Mm-hmm. That's That's hard work for which you, I hope, get enormously rich and famous. And yet it's your joy.
Yes, but it's my joy for an interesting reason, because I never did it to make money. I think one of the differences here is a lot of the work that people find the most rewarding are things that may take a long time and may not be the things they do directly for money, but for the things in themselves. And that's a lot different than doing it for the cash. It feels different. Work feels different when you don't have to do it for the money.
Well, you got paid for this. You did it in work time.
Yeah.
It was part of a teaching mission that certainly drew on it, and you drew on the teaching. I mean, it's not exactly separable from your work. This isn't something you crocheted in your, you know, in your off hours outside your work. I mean, I think there are a lot of folk who, for whom it's hard to say on the workplace. I mean, they're choosing things to read, to teach, to, in this case, talk about. It's hard to separate this from your leisure or what you do for the fun of your life.
Right, and I think that one of the other things I say in the introduction of the book is that one thing I had to keep in mind the whole time writing this book is not everybody has a job like mine, and that we need to look at all different kinds of work. And that's what makes it difficult. People experience work in different ways. Some people like to do things I would never like to do, and a lot of people would hate my job. So it's an interesting variety when you're writing about a subject like this to try to encapture all of the human variety we have to deal with.
I want to ask you, but ask Connection listeners too, how it is we come to be. I mean, work has never been more fashionable in a way. It's we love Asians because we think they're hard workers, and we have enormous prestige in the world because in our productivity and our output, we know that we're hard workers. It is sort of the rule. I mean, the ant has never had more of an advantage over the grasshopper in terms of the way what people respect. And yet you suspect a lot of it is nonsense. I mean, Tom Peters and the sort of the ideology of the new work of the 90s is all about sort of celebrating yourself as a corporation, investing yourself in what you do, being your job 24 hours a day, this kind of thing, finding your identity as a triumphant worker. Is this wrong?
I think this gets us to the basic question of meaning. And I'm not sure corporate America is best set up to decide what makes life meaningful for people. And Tom Peters and a lot of management writers have spent an awful lot of time trying to figure out how to create a meaningful life for people by sucking them into the workplace.
You reach for your gun every time they say meaningful.
Right. I mean, why would a corporate manager have an insight into the meaning of life? People look for meaning. It's something you find, but it's certainly not something that a business person or a corporation has a great insight into. There are ethical obligations corporations have to people, and one of them that I state very clearly and I think is important is that they have an obligation to treat employees in such a way that what they do at work does not destroy or harm their ability to enjoy a good life at home. And I think that's the obligation they have, not deciding through motivational seminars and pep rallies at the workplace what's going to make people happy and excited.
Is this disinformation when they talk about sort of invest in the teamwork, the spirit, the meaning of this car we're making or something? I mean,
Well, there can be meaning, but I think the first condition for finding meaning in your work is being treated as an adult and being treated as someone who has rights and is respected. You don't do that by trying to manipulate people. And an awful lot of management, I go through the past 100 years of management in the book, has been a kind of manipulation, has been a kind of let's get people's lives more and more into the corporation. And we know right now in a fickle economy that putting people's lives into a corporation is not a very smart strategy, because the corporation is fickle and it will drop you in a heartbeat.
Maybe the best advice I ever get was from Scotty Reston, famous journalist of the New York Times in Washington. He said to me at one critical point, he said, just remember, your job is a means to your private life. I think that's
That's right.
More or less your theme, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It's a means to it, and your job may be wonderful, but that's something
his
you
work,
find.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm not saying that work is bad by any sense of the term. What I'm saying is people have to reflect on the place of work in their lives, which is a much bigger question.
What if, and I put this to connection listeners too, what if, as it works out, your workplace is in fact your community? Mm-hmm. Maybe that is your private life. Maybe that's where your deepest friendships and most enthusiastic connections in life really are.
Mm-hmm. I think for most people they are, but what's interesting about it is that if all of your friends are in the workplace, and I talk at the end of the book about prayer groups in the workplace, if you go to church in the workplace, you have all your friends in the workplace, and your social life is in the workplace, what happens if you get downsized? Where's your community? You lose your friends. You often lose your daycare. You often lose your health benefits. So part of what I say is in the new economy, as we look to the future, we ought to think about spreading our lives out around the community in different ways. We shouldn't let it all be dependent on the workplace because we can't depend on the workplace.
1-800-423-8255 makes the working life connection with Joanne Chula. Connection listeners, do you work to live? Or do you live to work, as so many people do nowadays? Or do you work to shop? And what would you do if you didn't have to work? Or if you just decided you weren't going to work? 1-800-423-8255 is our phone. Wendy is in Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi.
Hello, Wendy.
Hi. Well, my first thing that I wanted to say is I hate to work.
Are you lazy?
I'm a social worker, but I'm also a mom, and my big thing right now is that that's what I really live for, is to be a mom. Mm-hmm. But in our American society right now, women are expected to do everything, to work, to be a mom, to take care of the house, and that's really something I struggle with every day. So if I could have it my way, I would quit my job and stay home and raise my kids.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you try it?
Pardon?
I say, why don't you try it?
I'm trying. We're trying to get to that point. My husband and I both went to grad school and have all these, you know, school loan payments and this and that. And I guess we didn't really think about that at the time as, you know, how's that going to affect us when we want to start a family? Mm-hmm. We were so, you know, go to college, do your career, that kind of thing, that we didn't think about what that would be like in a few years when we wanted to start a family. So now we're kind of stuck financially in a way. But we are trying to work towards that, and that's really what I want to do.
Well, Wendy, you know, a lot of women are in your situation, and one of the things that we often forget about the whole feminist movement was that feminists wanted a choice. It didn't mean you had to go to work. They wanted a choice about whether they would stay home with their children or go to work. And a lot of times I think people forget that, and they think that, in order to be, you know, an educated, sophisticated woman, you have to go to work. Well, no, you just want to have the ability to choose whether to work.
Hmm. I'm sure you know that the work Wendy does at home with her children, and it used to be a sensitive thing to talk about, is real work. But it's also, you would say, It's real life even more.
Mm-hmm. It's both. And actually, I mean, in some ways, a woman staying at home or a man staying at home and taking care of the home and the children, they do an awful lot of work. But in some ways, the structure of their work is a lot better than someone working in a corporation because they can structure the tasks they want the way they want. They can structure the time the way they want. They have a lot more freedom in their home workplace than you would
deconstruct and maybe just sort of deprogram all that advice that came with President Clinton's welfare reform. We used to hear a lot about it from Governor Weld in Massachusetts, that it's a good thing for children. Implicitly, he was often talking about black and brown children in ghettos to see their moms going off to work in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to get them out of the habit of mothering all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What was that all about?
Well, I think that's that one-dimensional
view. Bill Weld's mother stayed at home.
Right. And probably a lot of people's mothers out there stayed at home, but they worked at home. They did a different kind of work. So what it says when you deconstruct it is that the only work that's valuable is the one you get paid for. And I think that's a very big problem in this sort of over-emphasis we have on work in our society today.
1-800-423-8255, the work connection. David is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, David. Welcome.
Thank you. You know, I... to answer your question, I think a lot of people work to pay the bills, essentially. I've been in healthcare for 6 years, and just about 3 weeks ago, wanted to completely get out of it and do what I really wanted to do, and something that was really invigorating.
Which was?
Gardening and garden insulation and being outdoors and kind of benefiting from that, as far as, you know, it made me feel more spiritual. The healthcare field was making me have scars on my head from banging my head against brick walls. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, especially me, you know, I couldn't do it. I could not make that shift because the mortgage was too high or the bills needed to be paid. It just, and I'm 28, people say to me, well, you know, you're young and you can do it. And, you know, now I made a lateral move. I'm still in healthcare, but I can work from home and I'm on the road. And, but it's not the same. And every day it's, oh, you know, I wish I was doing this. I wish I was doing this.
Well, you know, what's interesting about your dilemma is that everybody usually has to balance three things. You have interesting work as one value. You have leisure as another value. You have security as another value. And you have what I call consumption as your fourth value. We'd like to have lots of all of these things. Great job, lots of money, lots of leisure, lots of security. Unfortunately, we often have to make trade-offs between all of them. So it sounds like you've made some trade-offs here because you wanted more time or you wanted to change the structure of your time. Mm-hmm. One solution to this sort of problem that there is a group that talks about is the simplicity movement. And part of what they say is you give up a lot of your consumption, so you decide how to scale back your life. But that's, of course, a lot easier said than done when people have bills and children and things like that to take care of in our society. But it is worth thinking of things in those terms and thinking about, well, which ones are the most important and which ones am I willing to give up and able to give up to lead a happier life? Mm.
Your whole book really is urging people to reprioritize or just think through the list again of what they want in life. We'll come back to that. 1-800-423-8255 makes the working life connection with Joanne Chula. Steve is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Steve.
Hi. I'd like to say that I see this as a society that very much judges people as human beings in financial terms. And success is seen in financial terms.
Locate the source of that accent, Steve.
I'm from England.
Okay. What part of England?
Manchester. Northwest.
Employed or unemployed?
At the moment, we just bought a house, so I'm working full-time on the house.
Oh, good. Okay.
There's a lot doing to it.
Good.
But I was previously a massage therapist. I used to do on-site massage. And I'd go around offices, and believe me, there's not a lot of happy people around the offices. I would go in there.
You know the workplace, then.
That's right.
But I'm also being from England. We were routinely used to having, you know, 6, 7, 8 weeks a year off. Over here, it seems, you know, 2 weeks, and then all that extra money is thrown into the next consumer product, which is what the success comes from. Where, quite frankly, I'd much sooner go off around Europe and have a couple of months in the summer. But that's just my way of seeing it.
We get and spend too much. How, just quick observation, Steve, on the difference between, you know, Midland Brits and Europeans on one hand and Americans on another on this work thing.
First of all, this is obviously a much richer country than England is, and there's a lot more poor people back home, but there's a lot more working class pride back home, people who are poor and proud and just proud of who they are. They're not aspiring to be something they're not. And I just don't see that over here. Everybody is so focused on earning money, you know, to the exclusion of having a good life often, I think.
Well, sounds like a disciple of yours, Joanne.
Well, I have to make a confession, Steve, and that is that part of my book was actually written when I was at Oxford, and I've been very influenced by some of the British writers, especially William Morris on work, and some of the best research on work is Tavistock Institute research. And so,
the old-fashioned William Morris or a new?
The old-fashioned William Morris, yes, who talked about, he had a wonderful quote on work that I love in the book, and he says that what work has to do for a person is work gives people hope. And he says it gives them hope of enjoying their product, it gives them hope of leisure, and it gives them hope of using their product. And this is in a piece he wrote on work and beauty. And I think hope and work is a very interesting idea, because if you have too many aspirations, hope becomes an extremely complex thing. It's not a soothing thing. It's a runs you ragged, and we Americans often just keep wanting more and more. But you're absolutely right. I've observed that. I've spent a lot of time in Europe, and they do have. But what scares me about Europe is every time I go there, they seem more and more like Americans. So
I'm
worried
true.
About that.
It's
yeah.
getting that way.
It is, yeah. Especially in London.
Steve, how long can you sustain yourself working on your own house as your main job?
Well,
your main job?
I'm quite lucky in that my wife's a lawyer, so
let her work.
Well,
I get it.
I had an amendment to that. She's been working as a lawyer for 3 years, and she specifically picked a company which is going to give her. She doesn't get as well paid as some others, but she gets a lot more free time than certain other companies she could have worked for. So I will add that one to the to what I just said. Because, again, she's like me, we want to spend as much time as we can traveling and enjoying ourselves and not just working.
Well, good
for you. You don't need to read the book, Steve. You've learned the lesson.
You've written the book.
1-800-423-8255, The Working Life Connection. Why do we work so hard, Connection listeners? Jerry's in Burlington, Vermont.
Hi.
Hello, Jerry.
How are you today? I
working too hard, but otherwise fine.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. That is everybody's complaint. You know, working.
But they don't work for Mary McGrath.
Well, you know, I'm doing the best I can. Actually, I'm self-employed. That is, I own a restaurant, and it's a good restaurant. It's a place people can be proud of. I also do writing in my spare time, which is very positive to me. You know, I love doing this. All of these things. But I noticed quite some time ago, we have some staff, we have a large staff, and we have some who stay with us a long time and some who just go. And they're nice people. Well, no, I want to do this, and I want to go to Austin, Texas, or I want to join a band. And it's only recently that I heard a theory that really strikes me as very valid, that they can't commit to you because employers in general these days don't commit to the worker. They may never have been that wonderful, but I was just hearing about layoffs in Rochester, New York today. Mm-hmm. And the employee can't trust the employer. We in 15 years, I think we fired people like six times, you know, and I believe with cause. But we try to stay with our people as much as possible, but they're being trained so well by this whole country that you cannot trust your employer. He's going to screw you. And it seems to be true all the time. And you have to protect yourself. If I say, well, you've gotten an offer of so-and-so there, I'll match the offer, I'll beat it, whatever it is, I can't keep them. I can't keep them. And it's sad. It's really sad because we have a very unique product. And people want to stay. They always say, I love your place. It is the best place I ever worked, but I don't want to stay on. And I think it's a subliminal thing that they just cannot trust the system.
I don't quite get it, Jerry. I mean, What is the problem there? How do employers screw their employees other than by, you know, shipping off to Singapore or something?
Well, that's a big thing, isn't it? I mean, I remember a few years back when Clinton said that we're now in a small business economy, as though that were a wonderful thing. You know, he was saying that, you know, we're mom and pop are our employees. Well, that's not such a wonderful thing. I used to work for Ford, and it was a terrible place to work for, but at least we had a decent wage at the end of the week. Mm-hmm. Now it's very hard to scrape it. When the guy who was laid off, or the woman who was laid off at Ford, now is scraping to get a McDonald's job or something, mm-hmm. perhaps in computers, which then may be laid off. I had a friend who was a vice president of a computer company. She was just fired summarily when it was eaten up by another one. You know, in the past, they had done the same thing to others, and she was secure at that point. Mm-hmm. And suddenly she's gone.
Jerry, thank you.
Okay.
Eventually, everybody, it's not news anymore that the sort of social compact with workers is gone. We live in a ruthless economy, mm-hmm. and it trickles down into the heads of employees, too. Is it going to be that way forever now?
Well, I think people are starting to realize, and first of all, I want to congratulate Jerry that the paradigm of the best kind of work in America has traditionally been to own your own business, which explains Clinton's comment, but you're absolutely right. It's hard work owning your own business, and, you know, a lot of people fall from grace when they work for these big companies. So the social contract that got destroyed really late 80s, early 90s with all these big corporations, and we heard about the big layoffs, it had a ripple effect, because even in our almost full employment economy, people feel insecure about their jobs, even though they know they can get jobs elsewhere. Is it going to last forever? Well, the one thing that I think corporations are going to have to spend an awful lot of time on is figuring this out, because trust is something, and trust and loyalty, you have to give trust and loyalty to get trust and loyalty. And once you decide that you're not going to be responsible for giving it, you can't expect it from anybody. So I think you're feeling what a lot of people in the country are feeling. The only way to reestablish it is to try to create some semblance of security or some alternative job arrangement for people so that they can have some sense of security in their working lives.
We're still in the middle of an enormous job transition, jobs going overseas every day, and there will be more so after the China trade bill. At the same time, we have the lowest, steadiest unemployment, under 4% in my lifetime. Is this a respite? Is this relief for the anxious class or not? Or is it just a condition we're going to have to live with?
Well, I think a lot of people have a sense it's not going to last forever. And a lot of people are wondering, well, and then what? What will happen when the bubble bursts? So I'm skeptical. We all know from history these things don't last forever.
Are you anxious? I mean, do you feel that sort of thing?
I don't feel it personally, but I feel it when I talk to people about their work. And the idea is also that you've got to work really hard now. I mean, let's look at the time issue, because that's what a lot of people complain about.
Save the time issue until after the break.
Sure.
Connection listeners, do you want to take your job and shove it? Do you want to talk about it? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the working life, which is the title of Joanne Chula's book about the promise and betrayal of modern work at a time when Americans work longer and harder than they ever have, even in this enormously booming economy in which a lot of the heavy lifting and manufacturing and hard work has been shipped elsewhere, and where every kind of technology ought to be making it easier. Joanne Chula, what if the simple fact that people work so hard is an index not of how much they love their jobs, but of truly how anxious people are in this economy?
Yeah, in the book I tell a story that I heard from people in a large corporation. I asked them to make up little cases about ethical problems they had in the workplace, and everybody had very technical cases, and this one group came up at the end and kind of timidly said, well, we're not sure we wrote the right kind of story, but here's our case. Our case is about Harry and Mary. And Harry doesn't have much of a life. He's single, comes into work around 7. Sometimes he stays as late as 11. Mary has children, is married, very active in her community. She comes to work at 9. She leaves at 5. This is a company that's going through a lot of downsizing. The question that they had was, if we downsize, and given that Harry and Mary have the same job evaluation, which employee will the employer keep? And it's a really interesting question, because it gets at some of this uneasiness people have, and one of the reasons why people work long hours, because they don't know when the good times are going to end. They don't know when their company's going to drop them like a hot potato. So they figure one way to show commitment to the organization is to work long hours.
With what kind of satisfaction, or does it matter?
It doesn't really matter. I think a lot of people have been sucked into it, that they want to keep their jobs. They know that even though things are good, they may not be good forever. And so as a result, what you hear a lot is, you know, they have no time for their children, they're stressed out, things aren't getting done. It's very hard for some people out there.
In your view, who have the really good jobs out there?
Who have the really good jobs? Well, I don't think that we can pick job categories. Of course, the press loves to write about the golden boys and girls in the high-tech industry who are making tons of money. They're fun to write about. They make lots of money. And they probably love what they're doing, and they're young, and they're intelligent, and they have a good time. So that may be nice. But what's interesting about work, and Studs Terkel's book, written in the early 70s,
indeed, yeah.
was a wonderful book, because part of what that book showed, and he interviewed a lot of people from washroom attendant on down, is that people find their work good for different reasons. So it could be a somewhat menial job that if you talk to a person, they enjoy. They may enjoy it because of the people they're with. They may enjoy it because they're treated with respect at work. They may enjoy it because the task at hand is interesting. I mean, sometimes people have fascinating jobs, but the people running the business or whatever make their lives so miserable that they can't enjoy the particular work they do. So we need to sort of break it up to really understand it. I don't think anybody has a perfect job. I mean, certainly I'm an academic. I admit I have a pretty good job. But, you know, there are parts of my job that are good and bad, too, like committee meetings or faculty meetings.
What's the best of it?
The best of it is when your students actually learn, when you actually produce a book that you feel comfortable with, or a paper or article, or when you're in the depths of research. I mean, writing this book is really 20 years of my research on all sorts of obscure medieval things about work, and you know, that's wonderful. But I think those elements, you don't have to be an academic to have them, can be found in a wide variety of human activities.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection, if you call this work. 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is on the line.
Hi. How you doing, Chris?
Good, Mark.
Hi.
I'm in a position, I've always done what I've loved to do, and you said Studs Terkel, it all flashed back into my memory. I might have read him in my third year of college, and that's when I left. I don't know, I can't blame it on him. And I've done things like sailboats, and currently I'm a tour guide in Boston, and I really enjoy it. I take people around on the trolleys, and I enjoy every minute of it. But my comment is, I've done it all my life now, never finished my college education, and now I'm into my early 40s. And you kind of look back and you look at the choices you've made, and should you have made different choices? I've gone for large periods in my life without health insurance. Now I'm back to where I have that opportunity, but do I stick with a job just for health insurance? At one time, I was not a homeowner. I've been fortunate enough to be a homeowner now, but do I have to keep a job that may not be fun anymore after a while just to keep my house payments? And, you know, 20 years have gone by in your life, and you look back, should I have done what my dad did, the corporate thing, and you just wonder, you know. But I enjoy my job every day, and I switch a lot. If I see something I might enjoy more, I always switch. But right now, life is fun, but it makes you wonder, where am I going to be in 20 mm-hmm. years from now without a big 401k and a retirement and a pension and that kind of thing?
Right. Well, it sounds to me like you're a grasshopper, first of all. I think that's just great. But if you look at what you've just told us, you look at what trade-off you've made. The one trade-off you're thinking about right now is security. And one way that people are able to do interesting things and have an enjoyable life is to give up security. That's what the grasshopper did. The grasshopper didn't save up food for the winter, and the grasshopper died. But the security issue, in different periods of your life, different things become important. And I think that's also what you seem to be indicating, that when you get to be around 40, you start thinking more about security than you may have thought of when you were younger. On the other hand, you've sounds like you've led a pretty good life so far. Now the question is, how do you get that little bit of security and some of those other good things that you also don't want to lose? And that's something that only you can answer, not me. Sorry.
It's nice to sort of count that psychic income, though, isn't it? 1-800-423-8255. David is listening online in New York.
Hello.
Welcome, David.
Thank you very much, and enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm an attorney at a large firm in New York, and there's been a lot of press how the starting salaries here just hit $140,000, mm-hmm. Which to my father's generation is just an obscene amount of money for a 22-year-old to pull down, obviously. But the billable hours they require are now over 2,200, which, as any lawyer putting these in, immediately calculates to over 10 hours a day, 5.5 days a week, based upon a 50-week work schedule. Hmm. But with student loans, you know, for attorneys, any professional, really, you know, MBAs, pick any professional school, you're coming out of schools with over $100,000 in loans, so you really don't have a lot of choice. And these choices, unfortunately, are made early. But I have a question for your guest. My generation seems like we're being cheated, but are we just whining? I mean, my ancestors landed at Ellis Island, and they worked hard 6 days a week just to eat. You know, never mind vacations and nice clothes and SUVs, and there was certainly no societal safety net 75 years ago. So are we just whining?
I don't think you're just whining. I wouldn't want to write it off to that. And by the way, my relatives came in on Ellis Island, too.
Mine, too. And aren't you supposed to be working at 10 o'clock in the morning?
Actually, I'm doing NPR for this time.
Good.
Oh, good. But I think the legal profession is particularly interesting. And one of the things I write about in my book is what happens when a profession goes from a task orientation, where you do the tasks of a lawyer, preparing cases or whatever, to a time orientation, where people become very fixated on billable hours. And one of the outcomes of this actually is sort of interesting, because it kind of takes what was nice about a profession out of the professions. And I think that's why a lot of lawyers that I've talked to in my research have become unhappy with their jobs, because they're worried about hours instead of being worried about the actual task at hand. I don't think your generation is whining. Having taught your generation for the past 25 years, I would say that your generation is quite aware of the frailty of the economy, even though it's good. And you're also looking around at everybody working so hard. And in my book, I talk about the history of how people have always had to sort of beat young people over the head to take on the work ethic. And my students, when they get out into the workplace, are thinking a lot about how to lead better lives than they've seen their parents leading, not just in material terms, but in terms of spending more time with their family and other things. So I think your generation's not whining. Yes, you have it good economically, but I also think that the world you face is a lot more complicated in terms of personal relationships and family life and other things. So it's good to start thinking philosophically about it, even at your age, even with your school debts.
David, thank you.
Thank you very much.
1-800-423-8255. Kay is on the line.
Hi, this is Kay, and I could go on and on about this topic. I can relate so much to the Harry Mary story. I'm in my early 40s and have been in outside sales for years, and am attracted to outside sales for two main reasons. The first main reason is because it's flexible, and I can work my career around my family and not my family around my career. My family has always come first. And the second reason is, of course, the money. But salespeople need to be motivated by certain things. And one thing that I offered to one of my employers once, and he was younger, like a Harry, very driven, was that as a reward, instead of money or whatever, give me some days off. I thought it was a great idea, and he couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that would be that important to me. I'm very active in my community. I'm in a lot of volunteer organizations, and even got to the point where he recommended that I might want to not be quite as active in my community, and I thought, how silly.
Mm-hmm.
How silly. And I could go on. I just could go on about this. I just refuse to be sucked into this big energy vortex.
Good to hear that.
So, I mean, any comments from you would be great, but I just see it time after time, these young kids making a ton of money, more power to them. I think that's, wonderful if that's what it means. But I try to keep my life very simple, and my job is just a means to food on the table.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not sure you could... We'd have you work in our office. I mean, this is tough.
I mean, we
might just need you.
I would love it. I mean, I just, I think we need to just stop and take a deep breath, realize what's important, and I think corporations need to stop and take a deep breath, realize what's important. And I have said this for years, most people only work really hard during the day for 5 or 6 hours anyway.
That's right.
Honestly, and I see that day after day. So make it a 5 or 6 hour work day. Forget about the rest. Let these people go home to their families and come back energized and refreshed put in another good 5-6 hours and call it a day.
IYD, you know that what that stands for?
I mean, hello.
Hello.
So that's all I have to say, but I could go on forever.
Okay.
Thank you for cutting it short, Kay. Honestly, thank you for calling. 1-800-423-8255. Maria is on the line.
Hello, Christopher.
Welcome, Maria.
And Joanne.
Hi.
It's a great show, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you for it.
It's because we work so hard.
That's right. Well, the thing that, one of the many things that your conversation has prompted is, and that I don't think anyone has talked about yet, is the idea of vocation, a calling. Because,
yes.
You know, I work professionally. I've worked all my life. And I think of my work as a calling, and it's not just an occupation, although I do need to make a living, I need to make money, but it's a slightly different way of looking at it.
What do you do, Maria?
I teach in a university, I teach at Brandeis, and I also am an actress.
Oh, great.
Good for you.
So I teach theater, but, and I've been in theater most of my adult life, but I also think of my work, and I love the fact that you're the previous caller talked about doing volunteer work. I'm also very active with my church and in various ministries because I feel very strongly that I don't want, as you talked about earlier in your program, I really don't want my life to be about making money.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want my children or myself and my husband to get caught up in the importance of material goods, because they really aren't very important, and yet having meaningful work is important.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of it as more than just meaningful work. But I believe that we're all given certain gifts, that we have gifts, and we need to share those gifts, and that's part of what makes our work meaningful. To have a voice, to have a calling, to feel that what you're giving of yourself is of lasting meaning.
How does a person know it's a calling? And what is the process of sort of holding out when you, as you plan your work life for a job that feels called?
Well, I wish I had an easy answer to that, because I feel like that's been so much of what my own process has been, having to constantly reevaluate, what am I doing? Is this important to me? Does this really, does this have meaning beyond, you know, even in the theater, you can get caught up in the idea of just having a career, and you just work one job after another in order to feel important, even though we will never make as much money as the lawyer who was on earlier. So I don't have the answer. I think there's a, you know, earlier, Joanne, you talked about priorities. And I think that's one place that we start. We have to really look at what our priorities are. I decided at a very young age that having things was of very little value to me.
Mm-hmm.
What my children thought about me and my grandchildren would eventually hopefully think about me was more important than things. And being able to do what gave me some heart satisfaction was important to me. Because even working for me, even though I work in a university, because my university doesn't believe that you can tenure artists, we still are the lowest of low on the totem pole. So I love my life in academia, and I love my students, and I love sharing with them. It is not a highly remunerative job.
No, it isn't.
You're a lucky lady, Maria.
Yeah.
And thank you for calling. 1-800-423-8255. Tom is in Boston. Hello, Tom.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
I guess there's a couple things I want to say. I work as a child psychiatrist. I'm still in residency training, but I see my job as having kind of three components. There's the component that I do each day that I love and that I enjoy, and I feel like I try to live that part of my life as if I had won the lottery. And if I won the lottery, I would still do that.
Right. That's a good test.
There's part of my job which is on call at night, waking up at 3 in the morning to go see people. And that's kind of like putting in the hours so that a couple of years from now I don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another aspect where I do jobs on the side, which is purely to make money, that I need to pay my mortgage and pay my bill. And that's something that I would give up if I won the lottery. So I feel like it. You know, in a couple of years from now, I'm hoping that I will be living a life in which I will make some money, but if I had won the lottery, I would continue to do what I do because I really love it and enjoy it.
It sounds blessed, man.
Yeah, it does sound good. And Tom, are you familiar with the experiments on children on intrinsic motivation? Have you read about those?
Experiments on children with what?
Intrinsic motivation. Where they pay children to play with their favorite toys?
No, I'm not.
Oh, it's a wonderful set of experiments that they take children in a kindergarten class and they pay them to play with their favorite toy. And what happens is the children start losing interest in the toy. It's the overjustification effect. And I found it a very interesting set of research for thinking about work, because so much of what people do, and our last caller, when she was talking about her work, so much of what she does is not for the pay, but it's for the intrinsic pleasure of what she does. And I always found that a useful way to think about what work really makes us feel most satisfied.
Exactly.
How does it work, though, that to be paid for your pleasure undermines the fun of it?
Well, think about it this way. I write about this in the book. I like to cook, and a lot of people like to cook. And sometimes you say, gee, maybe I should open a restaurant because I love to cook so much. But opening a restaurant and cooking is very different than cooking for your friends.
Okay.
And so you discover that some things as a paid occupation are not half as fun as just doing them for the sheer pleasure of doing them.
I get it. All right. 1-800-423-8255, the Working Life Connection. With Joanne Chula. Kristen is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Kristen.
Yeah, I think your last point, the guest's last point, is really useful. And I'm actually a graduate student in astrophysics, and I really feel, you know, kind of moved by what I hear people seeing here. My peers and I are always talking about how we love what our work does for us philosophically. But at the same time, we see our friends from college and high school going out and getting incredibly well-paying jobs and having stock options and leisure time and vacations and things where they can visit their, you know, time to visit their friends and their starting families. And we're in our mid-20s, and we haven't yet made more than $20,000 a year. And we're doing highly technical jobs that essentially take all of our mental energy every day. So I think what you were saying about just now about, well, there are plenty of things you can do as a hobby, but they're very different as a paid profession is extremely true. Mm-hmm. So I thank you for...
there are no stock options in astrophysics?
Oh, goodness.
Do you like it, though?
I love Kristen. It. I love it. I do work that pertains to the amount of life in the universe that the universe could hold, and it's incredibly, it's a boost every day intellectually. At the same time, I think there, you know, what the work has done, the meaning it's given to me has shown me how meaningful life is on Earth. You know, your family, the people you love, you know, other things. It makes me want to go out and experience other aspects of the world, you know, politics, volunteer work, you know, and so it cycles back, and it wants to take me away from that career now, right, and say, okay, you know, now I really appreciate the meaning. Seeing how small we are in this universe, it makes you want to really treasure and make an impact on the world around you now.
Kristen, if you find work on other planets, send back word. But Joanne Chula, I mean, I just wonder, we've got a minute to wrap it up. Your book is really not so much, well, it's about work, but it's about the meaning of life. Give the short course in a minute on how you inventory your life and where you're getting real meaning and how you can change it.
I think I can say it in one sentence, actually. I think the book that I'm a philosopher by training, and the book that I wrote is just to give people some things to think about their own lives. But the one test case I give at the very end of the book is that one way to test whether your work is really good is for some people it makes sense to work all the time. I'm not saying everybody has to balance work and leisure. For some people it may make sense to work all the time, but the real question you have to ask yourself is, does the work that I do make the rest of my life good?
Does the work that I do make the rest of my life good? That's an interesting question. What if we just invented a 36-hour day? Wouldn't that solve the problem?
It might help a little bit.
A lot more work, a lot more leisure. Joanne Chula, this is a wonderful book, and you're a wonderful writer. The book is called The Working Life, The Promise and Betrayal of Modern Work. Listeners, you can continue the working life conversation on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. Our website producer is Jim Norris. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by heroic workaholics Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our hardest worker and straw boss. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.